Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Ros Taylor. For anyone on the left or centre-left, the past decade or so has been a terrible time in politics. We've groaned and raged, we've despaired of making our voices heard, and usually we haven't managed to do so. What's it done to us, and how can we escape the cycle of rage, powerlessness, and more rage? Raphael Baer is a Guardian columnist and the author of a new book, Politics, A Survivor's Guide. Welcome to The Bunker, Raphael.
Thank you for having me in The Bunker. Thank you for having me back in The Bunker.
The subtitle of the book is How to Stay Engaged Without Getting Enraged. Let me push back a little bit on that. Do we actually need the rage to get things done? Do we need a bit of grit in the oyster?
Well, I definitely make the distinction in the book between anger, which is essential, and the kind of incapacitating rage that makes people want to throw up their hands and despair of politics. I quote Philip Roth. He says, anger is to make you effective. And if it doesn't make you effective, drop it like a hot potato. You know, that's its evolutionary function, is to animate you. And that's very important because, yeah, exactly as you say, if you didn't get angry when you see injustice or when the system's not working, there would be no impulse to change anything. Whereas I think that there's something different has gone on recently, which is a kind of impotent rage and a synthetic rage that is stirred, and you see it, you know, a lot on social media, but I don't think it exists entirely because of or exclusively on social media, but a kind of hollow, empty, but very noisy and powerful grievance that is actually really kind of inimical to the process of actively changing politics and particularly to the process of practically finding solutions. So yeah, the answer to your question is anger is important, but anger has to make you effective.
So how do you know when you're not being effective anymore? Is it where you're being angry, or is it how you're expressing your anger? How do you personally have felt in the past, or if you've, right, this has gone too far?
Well, I think, well, certainly, I mean, on a personal level, when it is a kind of fury. I mean, the Greek mythology of the Furies, are these sort of vengeful goddesses who sort of send you mad as sort of punishment for some terrible sin you've committed. I don't know what the sort of moderate centre-left did to deserve the sort of the attack of the Furies. But no, so that, and you know that feeling because it's incredibly stressful. And the episode I describe at the beginning of the book, which was the sort of the spur to writing the thing, was I had a massive heart attack, and I didn't have a heart attack because Britain left the European Union or anything. That would be weird. I had all sorts of other bad habits and dietary and the rest of it. But the immense stress that I felt running up to particularly the 2019 general election, when I look back on that time, it's actually the sort of the cognitive functions weren't operating properly. And this, I mean, I don't, you could drill into the neuroscience of it if we like, and there's a bit of that in the book. But that sense that the kind of troglodyte, irrational part of your brain, your amygdala, sort of hijacks the rest of your mental faculties so that you're not actually able to do the ruminative thinking and to take a step back and actually understand what's going on. And in practical terms, again, in answer to your question, you notice that when, particularly when you feel everything is ad hominem, or every criticism of a point has to be sort of witheringly sarcastic or directed at someone's underlying motive. And then you've sort of detached the function of empathy that would enable you to understand why someone who you really disagree with has reached the position that they've come to. And one of the big challenges for me in writing the book, and other people can judge whether I sort of solved it or not, is this tension between, on the one hand, still thinking that Brexit, for example, was a terrible idea and wrong and doesn't get a better idea because a majority of people voted for it. It doesn't start being a good idea because it's just a settled now consensus in British politics that we have to do it. It's still a stupid idea. But if you then take that as the premise for which you no longer have an obligation to care about the interests and the needs and the political grievances of the people who really passionately wanted it and still feel it's very important to them, well, then you're not going anywhere. Then nothing moves forward. And how you do that, how you sort of combine empathy with your own values, your faith in your own values still being kind of true, I think that's hard across a whole range of policy and not just in the UK.
And there's a point in your book where you make a point that some readers may well disagree with, which is that it is important in a democratic society to respect the result of elections. And that includes the referendum, even though it was so flawed.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I came to that realisation actually before even 2019, I think. And I was very ambivalent all the way through. And I went along to the rally, Remain rallies, where people were demanding a second referendum. And even while that was going on, in the back of my mind, and sometimes I put it in print, was this qualms like, is this really working? And it's partly because the presentation, I mean, the fact is the People's Vote campaign was, I think it was Caroline Lucas actually described it as a sort of playpen of liberal grandees, of ancien regime grandees who sort of wanted, and it was just, it sent all the wrong signals. But also in that, and everyone listening to this probably remembers that awful period where, it was just sort of trench warfare, where politics felt like the Western Front and nothing was moving. But it was also a sense of incredible, so combination of perpetual crisis and stasis at the same time. And what happened, as I'm sure you remember, was that the Remain argument seemed to be winning all sorts of tactical positions in the weeds of parliamentary procedure. And what they, and by they I mean we, hadn't fully understood was that for a lot of people, the commanding heights of the argument had already been occupied on a broader democratic proposition, which was people voted for it. Why isn't it happening? And the Brexit Party brilliantly mobilised that and manipulated that. And it comes back to the sort of paradox I was sort of alluding to earlier, which is particularly when aspects of the Leave campaign and Leave campaigns plural were just vile and horrible and xenophobic and mobilised the most sort of atavistic, horrible kinds of politics, that gave Remainers a kind of permission to think, well, this is actually an assault on liberal democracy. So our values as Democrats, this is so nationalistic and points to an abyss into which we don't want our politics to slide. We have a moral high ground. And then, of course, the Leavers think, well, actually, we have a democratic moral high ground because we voted for it, do it. And somewhere in that, there's just a tension between representative parliamentary democracy and direct plebiscitary democracy. And that's just a sort of constitutional theoretical tension. But somewhere also, there's this awful kind of moral deadlock where people like me got to feel self-righteous about ultimately being right and vindicated, and the Leave campaign was fraudulent and they probably cheated in all sorts of ways, and therefore it's not valid. And having to accept that, unfortunately, it is also the case that it was an enormous democratic event, and a lot of people turned out who'd never voted in their lives before and felt that this was the one opportunity they were getting to really change things. I mean, I'm going on a bit, but that's the tragedy of it. And the thing I get so frustrated by and that I try and explore in terms of something that was paradoxically a genuine revolution and a massive heist and a fraud. And it can be those two things at the same time. And the Remainers were sort of genuinely behaving like a sort of a grumpy ancien regime who'd lost their privileges and were feeling a bit embittered about that and didn't really understand the country that they claimed to be for which they claimed to be the consensus, but also on the side of decency, moderation and liberal democracy. And those two things can be true at the same time. But it was incredibly difficult to articulate any of that in the middle of it when you're sinking into the bog of no man's land on the Western Front of politics.
Yeah, it was. And we got incredibly caught up with, as you say, the minutiae of parliamentary procedure and whether it was possible to use Parliament in new and innovative ways to get through what we wanted, and whether Parliament or the result of a referendum was supreme and all this kind of thing. But as you say, ultimately, the Leave campaign could always say to us, you don't trust the people. They voted and you're ignoring them.
Yeah, and there is no, and the argument that there is no such thing as one will of the people because there are multiple people with multiple wills, and politics is the business of mediating between conflicting interest groups, and therefore not everyone can get all of what they want all the time, and that's how representative democracy works. That was a theoretical argument which was hard to make anyway, and then particularly when you've got the prominent figures on the other side basically accusing you of being a traitor, a saboteur, mobilizing rhetoric that came directly from totalitarian regimes of the 1930s, the exact same idioms and formulae. It was hard not to react to that in a way that then confirmed the sense that you're having some completely hysterical overreaction to something that was actually democracy. And it's as I say, these things can coexist. And I remember talking to someone who's sort of a moderate conservative Remainer who said, you know, he's of all that's like, OK, you look at Parliament Square and there's, you know, Steve Bray bellowing out his thing. And then there were counter campaign, it was sort of protests by leavers. But actually, it was amazingly civil, really, when you think about it. I mean, it was, you know, metaphorically, it felt like a civil war. But there are an awful lot of countries where that would have been substantially more toxic and substantially more aggressive. And, yeah, in France, there would have been cars burning all over the place. I mean, maybe we should have burned more cars. I mean, it went to the, I don't think we should have burned more cars, by the way. Don't burn cars. You know, so those Remain rallies were extraordinary because millions of people, and they sort of picked up their own litter and had very witty placards. It was like a kind of the, it's like the sort of paramilitary wing of a Radio 4 panel show. It was sort of, you know, it was all incredibly arch and clever, and ultimately could achieve nothing. And just the sad and the bitter thing is, if all those people, you hardly needed any police officers there. If they had all rioted, you know, it would have been appalling, but it would have had, you know, the outcome might have been different. You know what I mean? And that's an awful thing to kind of contemplate, but you know, that's those cultural complexities. I don't think we've really had a chance to process so much of that, because then by the time you got to 2019, Get Brexit Done was this very powerful resonant message of let's just stop talking about this, and it won with a landslide.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long cycle of demonstrations generally achieving nothing in British politics. I mean, Iraq War achieved nothing. And I wanted to get onto the Iraq War because it reminded me when I was reading your book of something that happened around that time. It was at the time of that march, and which was also very, very big. Millions, I think 2 million people went on that march. And I remember a colleague asking me if I was going to go on it. And I said, no, I don't see any point. It won't change anything. And I was right. Of course, it didn't change anything. But the fact was that at that time, I was in a very complacent place. And you talk about this in the book and the kind of mood that, especially living in London, you felt often in the late 90s and 2000s, where your people were in charge and there was bad stuff happening, but really it was easier just to, you know, just to mock a bit and live with it. And I remember doing a lot of things like watching the Jon Stewart show. And for me, that was kind of political engagement, as well as my job, obviously. Because it all just took place on a not terribly meaningful level. Is this something that you feel has happened as well, particularly to our generation?
Certainly, I don't know whether it's... I don't think it's unique to our generation, but I do think, looking back, that the pure accident of reaching my early 20s in the mid-90s when... It's not just in the UK. I mean, it's happened that there was just people were so fed up with the long conservative rule that and, you know, Labour still had a dominance in Scotland, so they could win very big, very easily. And Blair was an immensely talented politician. There are all sorts of things going on there. But just the sense that the entire country had gone, oh, we don't want the Tories anymore. Fantastic. And the economy was growing. Culturally, London, you know, it was the sort of era of Cool Britannia. You could feel that you were the capital of the world. You could still afford my first job, proper job after university, and sort of adjacent to journalism, wasn't really journalism, but I think my starting salary was £11,000 per annum. And on that, I could rent with some friends a flat in sort of Kennington, Stockwell borders, just like almost next to the Oval cricket ground. I can't begin to imagine what that would cost now. But you know, so just the how extraordinarily lucky, and my local authority had paid fees from a university. I mean, it was just, you know, drenched with these privileges that Gen X had. And okay, we're not boomers, but Gen X, we still got pretty lucky. And then nor late. And I think I was sort of aware of that, but thinking this is a great time to be young, you know, lucky on me, I'm in London having the whale of a time. What I hadn't fully appreciated is that the wider context of the Cold War was over. You had this budget dividend that you didn't have to spend on defence as much. You could put it into other things. There was just a global, the great moderation in economics, they call it, sort of the vast, there was a much bigger apparatus of complacency going on. And that I only became more aware of, I think, after, actually not even after Iraq, because with the Iraq war, that there was a lot of discrediting of politics that went on there. But actually, I was living abroad at that time. I was a foreign correspondent, and I looked in at that from a slightly different angle. It was when I came back and then you had the financial crisis. That was, I think, when I started to think, yeah, you've really taken your eye off a lot of balls here in terms of what's actually going on in this country and in the politics.
Yeah, it was like things can only get better became things will only get better.
Exactly.
And the whole end of history narrative somehow, you know, even if you didn't read Fukuyama, you still bought into it that it things were there were fewer wars, there were more democracies, there were fewer autocracies. All over the world, there was a sense that things were improving, and yet there were things going on. If we had only been looking, and especially as you all know, in Russia, that we just didn't pay enough attention to.
Well, the interesting one is in that. I mean, when I was writing about this. The thing that I kept coming back to me was, well, hang on, 9/11, right? That was history. Definitely was that had definitely happened then. Mm. That was big, but then actually you look back and there was a lot of talk and stress about, oh, there's this threat to liberal democratic values and civilization and jihadi terrorism is thing. But even then, it was all came from this incredibly still kind of arrogant, patronizing place, which is, well, these people are just sort of reactionary medievalists who just can't cope with secular modernity and. They're still a threat to life, but it's not actually a rival system that people... It's not like in the Cold War where you had people saying, no, maybe we should actually be more like East Germany rather than West Germany. I mean, as people did, wrongly, in my view. And so this idea that you could sort of almost patronise the alternatives, even while being afraid of it, or afraid of them, meant that that episode didn't register as a significant... turning point when from a period where what we're really talking about is kind of 1989 or an economic consensus that because of Thatcher Reagan probably starts 1979 into the geopolitical complacency 1989 through to 2007, 2008, I think.
So to return to Brexit briefly, we've done Brexit. We haven't really done Brexit, obviously, but nominally we've done Brexit. And I keep hearing that the Remain Leave divisions are no longer as salient as they were, which is a good thing. And yet we are constantly being pushed into the same mindsets. And the playbook that worked so well in 2015 and 2016 just keeps being brought out again with things like the culture wars. And to me, it seems to function a cycle of provocation that just builds and builds, where you are constantly provoked. And almost, there's not even a massive ideology, I think, behind. It's more of a cycle where you say something which you know will be rewarded because of the systems we have put in place and the social media in particular, but it extends beyond social media to journalism more widely. You are rewarded for moving to the extremes. You mention in the book that you have failed the question time selection process before. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, so I went on a Politics Live, or with its precursor, I can't remember what it was called, the one that Andrew Neil presented, and sort of sounded off a bit about Brexit, and someone clipped that and it went on YouTube and went viral. Almost immediately, for the first time ever, this sort of question time bookers phoned me up and essentially sort of go, oh, you seem to have opinions and lots of people are sharing them. Great. Maybe you'd like to be on question time. I said, sure. Yeah, I'm vain. I like going on telly. I'll be on question time. And then we had this weird conversation where the book would ask me a series of questions like, you know, OK, so, you know, welfare reform. For or against, like, well, it depends. You know, it depends what you're trying to do, what you're trying to achieve. And some bits, you know, if it's just a pretext to take money away from, you know, people who desperately need it, that's a bad thing. But if you're adjusting the incentives to get, you know, you understand it's complicated. Or immigration, for or against. Well, you know, obviously, no country in the world just has zero border controls. You have to have some mechanism for understanding who's in and not in your country. But if it becomes a sort of rhetorical cudgel to just mobilize xenophobic sentiment, no, I'm not going to be on the side of that. But it's complicated. And then we went through a bunch of these things, and it's eventually I could hear the person on the other end of the line sort of getting more and more despondent as I kept saying, it depends, it's complicated on the one hand, on the other. And after a while, it's actually it sort of stopped the conversation and said, I think I'm not the guest you're looking for. And they went, no, you're not. And so I didn't go on question time, which was probably for the best. But that sense of, I'm going back to what you were saying before, I think was, in terms of the systems and the economic system that is in place within digital media in particular to accelerate polarization, I think is very interesting. And two things happen there. One is, you know, I see this in what I write, and because you can see the sort of back end on the website and what's getting shared and what's not. And if someone writes something very provocative or extreme, you basically get a double hit because it gets shared by the people who passionately agree with it, and it gets shared by the people who passionately hate it and hold it up as an emblem of everything that's wrong. And that reflects something that's going on that's quite interesting in the sort of the wider polarization that you're talking about, because I think there is a myth that because we all, you know, get our information on the internet mostly, we occupy these terribly narrow information silos and we only see things that confirm our biases. And that's half true. Actually, and you know, the data show this, we see a much wider range of views than we ever used to. I mean, you and I are old enough to remember that, you know, when there are only three channels on TV and there might be one newspaper in the house that your parents bought. And so clearly you were getting less of, you know, that was an incredibly narrow set of data. Like the idea that we're now more narrow than that, it can't possibly be true. But the problem is when you are seeing, you know, I see lots and lots of leave, pro-leave opinions, but I see them presented to me by Remainers saying, look at this idiot. So the sort of pseudo-diversity that you encounter is actually part of a polarizing process. And there's there are economic incentives for that because those clicks count twice.
So the right are giving us something new to be enraged about, and in the form of national conservatism, which is something that I was barely aware of a week ago, but now seems to be all over my social media feeds, all over the things I read. And there's a lot of rage on the left about national conservatism. How should we respond to national conservatism?
Again, I think, you know, it's a big win for them, for the national conservative movement, which is an international thing. Because essentially, it's just, you know, as I'm sure people listening to this are probably now aware, that it sort of comes out of a conversation between the sort of the US Republican right, there's this Israeli right wing character whose name I now can't recall. It sort of crept into sort of Orbanism and that sort of East Central and East European form of nationalism. And it's not that, for want of a better word, indigenous to British conservatism. And you felt that very strongly when you saw some of the speeches that are being made at this convention that everyone's been talking about this week, in some of the very religious and evangelical dimension to it, or the conversations about, there was one conservative MP who was talking about sort of birth rates and fertility. And that's a big anxiety in countries like Poland and Hungary, where a lot of the young people have left, you know, they came to work in the UK when we had free movement, other countries. And this idea that you're being this sort of great replacement anxiety somehow, that your healthy white Christian stock is going to somehow be replaced by Muslims who are coming from, that's not, actually, obviously, mad racist nationalists in this country feel that, but it's not actually as resonant a part of the mainstream discourse as, for example, why isn't the NHS working? Or why can't I afford just to even get a shop at Lidl anymore? And so the answer to your question, I think, is don't panic. Like, what these people want is exactly what you're saying. They held this big conference. They got Suella Braverman to talk. They got Michael Gove to talk. So there's a Westminster and a lobby system that would much rather go to a carnival than pay attention to policy detail, went and had a great old jamboree picnic with some slightly crazy people and wrote it all up nonstop for 3 days. And that inflates it into something that it doesn't deserve. So I think it is important to say, well, yeah, some mad people who are good at mobilizing media attention let off a few fireworks, and predictably a large part of the Westminster political journalism sort of scene went ooh and ah because the fireworks went off. Does that mean that this is the way we're going in politics? I think it's significant in terms of what might happen to the Conservative Party in opposition in that case, then there's a consequent question from that, which is if the Tories in opposition get captured by this kind of stuff, will the wider cultural apparatus of conservatism, by which I mean the Mail, the Telegraph, you know, and the cheerleaders and the think tanks, go with that, as they have done in the US with the sort of madness of the Republican Party, or will they behave a little bit more like they did in the mid and late 90s and go, oh dear, the Conservative Party has become completely ridiculous. Let's laugh at them and agree with all the people who are pointing and laughing and going, actually, you're like maximum 20% of the country grow up. And I don't know which way that will go. But obviously, if it's the former, we've got a problem on our hands, because then it does get pushed into, it becomes normalised and it does become part of the cultural mainstream.
So this isn't a self-help podcast. You know, we're not in the business of explaining exactly what you should do to stop being enraged. But what do you do when you start to feel the rage build? I think we all have this. Is it a question of just logging off Twitter? Well, what even physically do you do? Do you go for a run? What's your response when it just starts pressing in and you want to tweet something really angry or shout at someone?
Well, definitely. Well, I have two. That's yours. I mean, I have available to me something which is, I suppose, is relatively kind of niche, which is I just can remember what it feels like having a massive heart attack, and I can actually sort of picture myself sort of basically on the pavement dying and thinking, let's not go back there. So that's actually a relatively straightforward kind of cognitive heuristic that is available to me, but I'm not recommending that to other people. Definitely, I think the Twitter thing or just social media generally is really important. It is useful. It's a tool, and I have fun engaging with people mostly who I agree with, but also I get exposed to interesting articles and things. I don't want to switch the social media off, but it is important to remember that some of the anger you feel in response to that is not actually your anger. It's synthetic anger that is being implanted in you. And also there is this, it doesn't need to be the first thing you look at in the morning and the last thing you see at night. But that's, yeah, so clearly just sort of creating some barrier between yourself and the thing that's going to make you angry. But also, I think it really helps, or the sort of the processes, the sort of mental process that I find quite interesting for this is understanding the difference between opinions and judgments that are formed as an analysis of the world that's outside you. So politics, how it works. Is it a good idea to do this? Should this policy be pursued? Is that a rational argument? And then values and opinions that are sacred to you. And by sacred, I mean, there's a very specific psychological term, which means a sense, some proposition that has fused with your innermost sense of identity, so that when someone criticizes it or disagrees with it, you don't hear a rational sort of proposition challenging something you think might be true. You feel a visceral attack on you and yourself. And we've all got them. And sometimes it might be something banal, like your support for a football club. But it might also be something like, if you're, you know, on the US right, your belief in the sacred right of Americans to have as many guns as they want, which from the outside looks mad. And if you say, clearly you shouldn't sell automatic weapons in the supermarket, that's a stupid idea. You know, only a mad person would think that. But no, that person is hearing, well, I hate America and I hate freedom. And we all have some element of what's sacred. But if someone feels their sacred values criticized, they take it as a personal attack. When you're attacked personally, you get that kind of adrenaline fight or flight response and you become aggressive. And I think there's a lot of what goes on, and it's a long way of answering your question, but I do think that it's important to understand that most of the time, the core, the root of anger and rage is fear. And so you think, what is this person who's being deeply unpleasant? Like Lee Anderson, his political persona presents as really deeply unpleasant, and he says some deeply unpleasant things. So you think, what is he afraid of? There's something there, isn't there? The sense that the world he knows is being taken away from him somehow, or he's not being respected enough, even though he's an MP. There's something. And once you see it from that point of view, not only does it mean you can be less angry yourself, but I think it's just more interesting as an avenue for analysis to ask that question than what's the snarky thing I can say about him to make him even angrier.
So understanding the psychology of the people who are saying things that you find outrageous.
That's a much more efficient way of putting what I just said. Yeah.
But you put it a lot more eloquently. Raphael, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you for having me in the bunker and on the bunker.
And Politics, A Survivor's Guide is published by Atlantic Books. If you want to carry on being able to survive politics, then don't just buy Raphael's book, although please do that because it is excellent. But consider backing us on Patreon too. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast. I'm Ros Taylor. Thanks for listening. Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker Daily was written and presented by Ros Taylor. The producer was Liam Tate, with audio production by me, Jade Bailey. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.